Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, offering 3 new Visa credit cards and 3 new checking accounts. WSECU's goal is to help make the right card make a difference. More information is available at WSECU.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
Maybe you could just sort of describe where we are in town and stuff like that.
Sure. So we are in Laurelhurst, which is right by Children's Hospital and U Village. So as you can see, I'm just a third of a block from my entrance of my office. We're at an intersection, and there are no curb cutouts at all.
Well, I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect. I'm here with Conrad Reynoldson, and we're standing at a pretty normal Seattle street corner, and you said there's no curb cutouts. What is a curb cutout exactly?
So curb cutout is the ramp that allows people in wheelchairs and with other mobility disabilities to safely cross the street.
And can you describe your mobility situation?
Sure. So I have a form of muscular dystrophy, and I use a power chair to get around.
Are you able to safely show us how you would navigate this intersection?
Sure. Yeah, so this particular one, I would have to go all the way down this block.
At the corner, Conrad has to take a right, maneuver around an inconveniently parked Lime bike, and roll a full block before a driveway provides an off-ramp. Then across the street, it's a left, and all the way back, to a spot about 15 feet from where we started, after traveling a total of 2 blocks. At the next intersection, the whole thing repeats. For people with mobility issues, this is a daily problem in Seattle. But Conrad happens to be an attorney specializing in accessibility. So rather than just accept it, he took the city to court.
So the basic legal basis of this is that local governments, state governments, they're all required to provide programmatic accessibility in the programs and services they provide, and sidewalks are a program of the city.
So anything that the city, any city-provided service has to be equally accessible.
Right.
And what did the city agree to do?
Yeah, so the city agreed to greatly increase the number of curb ramps they'd be addressing each year, and that number, with a few nuances, and they can have a bank if they're not caught up in a given year, is about 1,250 curb ramps a year, and around 20,000 total by the time we're done.
And that must have been empowering, right? The idea that you could kind of fight City Hall in some ways?
Right, yeah. It was empowering knowing that, you know, people with disabilities can come together, and if there is an issue like this, we can make our voices heard.
I guess, do you feel like this, or do you hope that this kind of sends a message to other people with disabilities or other people with, you know, differing abilities about how they can be proactive about, holding people's, the powerful people's feet to the fire?
Yeah, I hope it shows people that they can have a voice on these issues that matter, and that there are people out there who will advocate for the disability community and try to make it better.
How important for you and for clients is, you know, are these seemingly small accommodations in terms of being able to just live with dignity?
Yeah, and I think that's an important point that needs to be made, that we do these cases not just for the physical changes, but also to send the message that people with disabilities matter and are valued as much as everyone else. And I think it's important also, so people with disabilities feel like they have a voice and that they can do something when they know something isn't right and they know they're not being treated equally.
Our theme today on Sound Effect is truth to power. Whether it's a bureaucracy or a corporation or a foreign dictator, it's stories of confronting powerful people. As a kid, Elmer Dixon didn't know that someday he'd be taking on huge systemic problems in society. He grew up in Seattle's Madrona neighborhood, which at the time was really diverse. In the playground across the street from his house, Elmer says that you could find every kind of kid.
Chinese, Japanese, Korean, Filipino, black, white, Latino.
Elmer is African-American, and as a kid, he didn't have much of a concept of race. Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing tells us how Elmer Dixon went from blissful ignorance to opening up the first chapter of the Black Panther Party outside of California by the time he was 17 years old.
Growing up in the early 1960s, Elmer Dixon's parents exposed him and his siblings to all kinds of cultural experiences. They'd have Scandinavian dance parties with white friends in their living room. They'd play La Boheme while their children did the chores around the house. And they'd watch the news with their kids. Together, through the screen, they saw blacks in the South endure fire hoses, police dogs, and bombs as they fought for equality. Elmer says his parents shared their own stories of being victims of discrimination here in the Northwest.
My mother, after she showed up here in Seattle for her first job, responding to an ad and them telling her that the position was full when she got down there after she had called in and they told her to come in. She went away and called them again and they said that it was still open because they couldn't tell that she was a black woman because she didn't speak like what they thought that a black woman would sound like. And, you know, they were, of course, caught with egg on their face.
By the time Elmer was a teenager, his political awareness was coming into sharper focus. On April 19th, 1967, he and his older brother, Aaron Dixon, decided to go hear Stokely Carmichael give a speech at Garfield High School in Seattle Central District. Carmichael was the person who popularized the phrase black power.
The thing that I remember about his speech is him telling us that you don't love the fact that you're black because you've been taught and conditioned to think that anything black is bad.
If you want to start a fight, call somebody black. I ain't black, that's black, that's black. I ain't black, what you mean call me black?
A black mark on your angel food cake is white and devil's food cake is black. I mean, he drew all of these correlations to how we had been conditioned to think and believe that anything black was bad.
You are black and beautiful. Stop being ashamed of what you are.
You know, I became aware of who I am and what it meant for me as a black man, as a young black man.
In high school at Garfield, it was really hard for Elmer to just sit on the sidelines when leaders he admired were dying.
Medgar Evers, and then, of course, Malcolm X. The country was starting to bubble.
Elmer wanted to start a black student union at Garfield. The principal said no. So Elmer got kids to boycott classes and made a point by being silent.
One, we wouldn't say the Pledge of Allegiance. Two, we wouldn't stand up for the national anthem.
The protests worked. Garfield became the first black student union at a high school on the West Coast. Then, on April 4th, 1968, Elmer was in his geometry class when he was asked to come out of the room.
And right there are two detectives who immediately handcuffed me, told I was being arrested for charged with unlawful assembly, and they took me to juvie. And it was within the hour of Dr. King's assassination.
Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee.
It had happened, and they were getting the key leaders off of the street. So I was sitting in juvie, looking at the TV and watching America burn along with everyone else.
The police report that the murder has touched off sporadic acts of violence in a Negro section of the city. In a nationwide television address, President Johnson expressed the nation.
When they were let out of jail, they were mad. They were heartbroken. And like a lot of people who were part of the civil rights movement, they were done with being peaceful. Elmer and Aaron headed to Broadmoor, a wealthy gated community in Seattle that had a lush green golf course, a place that didn't welcome people of color.
We knew how to get in. You know, we went through the University of Washington Arboretum and went up on the golf course on one of their beautiful greens and poured gasoline into the shape of a big B and a big P and lit it on fire. Black Power.
Days later, with this new openness to being more aggressive and radical, Elmer and Aaron went to San Francisco for a conference of Black student union members. This is where they met Bobby Seale, the co-founder and the chairman of the Black Panther Party, a controversial political group that was considered by the FBI to be a serious threat to American democracy. Black Panthers fought for racial equality, and they did so while carrying guns and sometimes getting into violent confrontations with police. Elmer and Aaron happened to be in the Bay Area the same time that a funeral was being held for one of the Panthers' original members, 17-year-old Bobby Hutton. He was shot and killed by Oakland police.
The church was lined inside the church walls with young men and young women in leather jackets and berets and shotgun bandoleros across their chests and shotguns. And I was convinced it was a Black Army when I saw that. Bobby's mother, little Bobby Hutton's mother, Mrs. Hutton, wanted the public to see what the police had done to her son, the effect of being hit 30 times, you know, with bullets, a spray of bullets. There he was in his leather jacket, beret, and I looked in there, and he's 17 years old, and I'm 17, and I'm thinking that could be me laying in that coffin.
Elmer and Aaron opened a chapter of the Black Panther Party in Seattle. It was the first chapter outside of California. Elmer made the transition from being a high school student who never had a gun to being a well-armed college freshman at the University of Washington who traveled with bodyguards.
When I started at the University of Washington, I had bodyguards for a period of time. I couldn't take bodyguards on campus, so I would carry in my briefcase my psych book and a 357 Magnum. Because those were just the times.
The Seattle chapter of the Black Panther Party followed the organization's order to prevent police brutality against African Americans. Elmer and his comrades did this by patrolling the neighborhoods and tailing police cars.
When we confronted police, we had a law book. We knew that we had the right to observe them. And because we were armed, we had the ability to stop them. Law book and a gun.
Guns, they weren't always involved. The Seattle Black Panthers also started breakfast programs for kids who didn't have much to eat at home. They fought for more affordable housing. They helped people clear out roaches and rats from their homes, and they opened a medical clinic, which is still going today.
When we looked into the CD as an example and saw that we had the second highest infant mortality rate in the state of Washington, you know, we said, we can't have that.
All of these efforts were called Programs Pending Revolution. The idea was to bring stability to the African-American community, food, housing, healthcare, so that they'd be ready to fight in a revolution against racial injustice. That revolution never fully lifted off the ground. The FBI started to infiltrate the party.
They caused, through informants, for members of the party to go at one another.
In separate incidents across the country, shootouts with police led to the deaths of at least 3 police officers and 7 Black Panthers. In the late 1970s, with membership starting to fall off, the Black Panther Party disbanded. When Elmer Dixon started this journey as a teenager, he didn't think he would make it past the age of 22. He traded in his leather jacket and beret a long time ago for suits and ties. He has his own company, helping businesses find ways to have a more diverse workforce. Today, Elmer is living on the side of hope.
Women are getting into politics and winning, you know, and they need to push some of these old deadbeat white men out of office. I don't know where it's all going to end up, but I'm excited about the fact that people are beginning to wake up again.
Elmer has a message for the next generation that's trying to fight racism and injustice. He says that good will definitely overcome evil. He believes that extremists in this country are in the minority, and that we must not let that small number turn us into who they are.
That story from Sound Effects, Jennifer Wing. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today's theme is Truth to Power. So the year is 1981. People in Seattle who turned on Cairo 7 News on the evening of June 1st heard a report of a violent attack. Two men had been shot in the Union Hall in the Pioneer Square neighborhood.
Police say the man who made it to the sidewalk was the Union Secretary Treasurer. He was conscious when the medics arrived and taken to Harborview for emergency surgery. The man inside the office was dead at the scene.
Police the man taken to Harborview died the next day. This double murder started out looking like an internal union dispute, but the case is way more than that. We're talking intrigue worthy of a spy novel. It eventually led all the way up to a foreign dictator. Family and friends of the young men have been waging a fight for justice that's still going on almost 38 years later. Here with the story is KNKX reporter Ashley Gross. Hey, Ashley.
Hey, Gabe.
So this is a pretty straightforward story, right? This will be, you know, in and out a couple of minutes here.
Sorry, no. I'd say grab a cup of tea, settle in.
Got it. So it's some twists and turns here.
Exactly.
Okay, so who were these two young men who were killed?
Their names were Salmi Domingo and Gene Viernes. They were Filipino-American labor activists, officers in the cannery workers, Local 37. That was part of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. And it represented mostly Filipino-Americans who would go up to Alaska in the summer to work in the seafood canneries. Salmi and Gene, they were both 29 when they died. They were young, you know, ambitious and charismatic guys, but they were also really different from each other. Salmi was the college-educated sophisticate.
He drove a purple Monte Carlo. He had elevator shoes.
He dressed in velvet pants and high heel boots. He was in style at that period of time.
That's Cindy Domingo, Salmi's younger sister, and Michael Withy, a lawyer who was friends with both men. Gene Viernes came from rural Washington, and he didn't really care about how he dressed.
Gene was salt of the earth. He came from Wapato, and he wore a kind of a workman's hat.
He's quieter, a quieter person, was an inward thinker. Coming together, they formed a very dynamic duo.
So if they were so different, what made them such good friends?
They were just really committed to fighting for workers' rights and fighting for fairness. And they also really wanted to reform the union.
The union had been taken over by really what amounted to criminal elements. Tony Barroso ran the union with an iron fist and also, you know, was accused of taking bribes, getting a cut of the gambling proceeds up in Alaska.
So organized crime had a racket going on here, and the reforms that Gene and Salmi wanted to put in place that threatened to interrupt that. That really ticked off the gang known as the Tulisan Gang, and these were the guys who were running the gambling operation up in Alaska.
Oh, okay. So they were really poking the bear, huh?
Yeah, they were not afraid to challenge some entrenched and, you know, pretty dangerous guys. Shortly after that, Gene and Salmi were murdered. But Salmi survived long enough to identify the shooters. It was two members of the Tulisan Gang.
You know, Salmi, incredible courage to get outside the Union Hall with four 45 caliber bullet holes in him, watching his best friend Gene Viernes like bleed out on the Union floor, hail down a fireman, and then name who shot him. Then we had to fight for justice. We had to never, ever let this go.
A few months later, the gang members were put on trial.
Two members of the Filipino Tulisan Gang were convicted of the killings. Jimmy Ramil and Ben Galoy were given life prison terms for those slayings.
So the killers are caught, but I'm guessing that this is not the end of the story?
No, it's not. Family and friends of Gene and Salmi, they had serious doubts that the murders really stemmed from this dispute with the gang. They thought somebody much more powerful had ordered the killings.
You know, I would say it took us less than 48 hours to really kind of map out who benefited from the murders, and it was always the Marcos dictatorship.
Okay, so we're back in the 1980s Philippines here. This is the Ferdinand Marcos dictatorship?
Yeah, you know, some people may just remember stories of his wife Imelda and all her shoes.
You know what most people are interested in?
Mm-hmm.
Your wife's 3,000 pairs of shoes.
Ferdinand and Imelda Marcos, they'd gotten rich running the Philippines. Marcos had imposed martial law for 9 years and had cracked down on the opposition. He was jailing opponents. According to Amnesty International, tens of thousands of Filipinos were tortured and about 3,000 were killed.
Okay, but why did this authoritarian strongman in the Philippines care so much about these two American labor activists?
Right. I mean, these are just two young guys here in the United States. But Gene and Selmy, they were part of this anti-Marcos group here. And Gene had traveled to the Philippines and met with a guerrilla group that was fighting the Marcos regime and with some labor leaders at a May Day celebration.
Especially because he was visible during that May Day rally. He was already targeted for surveillance.
So Gene was already on the radar of the Marcos regime. But then he and Selmy did something else that probably angered Ferdinand Marcos even more. They pushed for their union, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, at the annual convention to take a stand in support of the workers in the Philippines and to send a delegation to investigate abuses over in the Philippines. That was probably threatening to Marcos because of the, you know, possibility that trade with the U.S. would be impacted if the longshoremen took action.
Oh, yeah. OK, so they're really going after Marcos where it hurts, it sounds like.
Right. And, you know, they knew that this was dangerous. Cindy says that they were fearful and Selmy had started to carry a gun. But no one really thought that, you know, their lives were on the line, especially here in the country where they were born.
So how would you even go about proving that Marcos was involved in the crime?
That's where it gets even more interesting. The murder weapon was found in a dumpster in West Seattle. And the owner was not someone in the Tulisan gang. It belonged to Tony Baruso, the president of the Cannery Workers Union. And that's where the link to Marcos comes. So Baruso had really admired Marcos. They had met. He had a photo hanging in his union office of him and Ferdinand Marcos shaking hands. And so family and friends of Gene and Selmy, when this murder weapon was found, they expected the King County prosecutor to charge Baruso. They thought, okay, he'll get charged, he'll flip, he'll explain the conspiracy, you know, and who ordered the murders. But the prosecutor didn't charge Baruso, at least not then.
We need our own vehicle for bringing about justice. So we designed this lawsuit against not the sovereign of the Philippines. It was called the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act, gave them immunity except if they committed a tortious act or a civil wrong, which includes murdering people, in the U.S., and we named Marcos.
They're suing a foreign dictator.
Yep. And I love this part of the story. They had to serve Ferdinand Marcos with the lawsuit. So they decided to do it when he was here in the U.S. for a really important meeting.
Mr. President, Mrs. Marcos, it gives me special pleasure to welcome you to the United States.
Marcos came here for a state visit with Ronald Reagan in 1982, and the friends and family of Gene and Selmy thought, okay, here's our opportunity to, you know, serve him this lawsuit.
And that means they have to actually hand him papers physically.
Exactly. So Michael Withy says they cooked up this scheme with a friend of theirs, Bill Davis, who was a Catholic priest. And they thought this is a way to grab Marcos's attention because he's from such a predominantly Catholic country.
He got dressed up in his priest garb and waited kind of in the vestibule behind some potted plants. And there's Marcos and Imelda and his entourage kind of walking down a long hallway. And so Bill Davis kind of steps out and Ferdinand Marcos looks at him and says, oh, hello, Father. What can I do for you? He says, Davis goes, here, I got something for you to read. And he hands him the complaint.
So picture this. Marcos has the red carpet rolled out for him there in Washington, D.C. He's meeting the president. And at the same time, he gets handed this lawsuit that's accusing him of being involved in the murders of these two young American guys. The whole lawsuit was really novel, and they knew it. The U.S. State Department argued that Marcos had immunity as head of state, and the judge agreed and dismissed Marcos from the case. But he allowed the case against the Philippine government to go ahead.
Okay, so they're suing the Republic of the Philippines. And this is kind of a crazy time in that country, right? What was going on there when this was happening?
Right, yes, it was really crazy. So an opponent of Marcos, Senator Benigno Aquino, he had been living in exile, but he decided that he wanted to return. So as soon as he landed there at the airport and he stepped off the plane, he was gunned down. There were just massive protests, and Marcos wound up calling for an election in 1986. Aquino's widow, Cory Aquino, ran against him. Marcos declared victory, but people didn't believe it. And he wound up just having to concede and flee. He fled to Hawaii, which is significant because He was no longer head of state, and he was now in the U.S., and so the lawsuit on behalf of Gene and Selmy got new life.
The day he got off the air base at Hickam Air Force Base in Hawaii, we slapped him with a subpoena, and so did U.S. Customs, and we got all Marcos's financial documents.
Those financial documents, that was like a gold mine. They discovered that Marcos's reach stretched deep into the United States, and they found that Marcos had set up a slush fund here in the U.S. to pay for all his covert intelligence operations, spying on anti-Marcos activists like Selmy and Gene. And not just that, they found the money trail that showed that Tony Barroso, the union president, and the head of the Tulisan gang had gotten paid out of the slush fund for the murders of Selmy and Gene.
Oh, wow. So that makes the link completely explicit. So Barroso, the guy whose gun turned up in a West Seattle dumpster, who was the head of the union, who was kind of connected to the gang and also kind of connected to Marcos, this brings it all together. It's clearly coming from the highest levels.
I mean, imagine finding a document like that showing the money trail. It's incredible. The judge allowed Withy to take a deposition from Marcos. So he and Selmy's widow, Terry Mast, traveled to Hawaii to depose Marcos. He was frail. He was on dialysis. He had to take a lot of breaks.
Well, I think it was really hard for Terry because there's the man that had her husband and one of her best friends, Gene, murdered, right? And for me, I was just steely determination that we're going to get this guy.
The judge allowed Marcos to be reinstated to the case. And then shortly before it went to trial, he died.
So where did that leave the lawsuit?
It proceeded against Imelda and the Marcos estate. And it went to trial in 1989 in Seattle. I asked Cindy Domingo how it felt. She said on the last day of the trial, she remembers looking around and seeing so many people there in the courthouse.
I said to myself, I said to Selmy, I said, I did my job. I carried out my commitment to you and Gene. And that for me, even if the verdict hadn't come in, in our favor, I would have been satisfied with the work that we had carried out.
So the verdict did come back in their favor? They won the case?
Yes, they won. The jury even awarded more than Withy had asked for. The jury awarded $15.1 million. They later settled for $3 million.
So they won this unprecedented case against a foreign dictator, and they got their vindication. But it sounds like that's not the end of the story either.
Correct. It's not. There's a whole other part of the case that I haven't talked about. That has to do with how much the U.S. government knew about the kind of spying that Marcos was doing here and whether the FBI and U.S. intelligence agencies had advanced knowledge of the murders. Michael Withy writes about all of this in his book. It's called Summary Execution. Now he's suing the FBI to force them to turn over documents. And a spokeswoman for the FBI in Seattle says they don't comment on ongoing litigation.
So what do you take away from this story?
What's striking to me is that Gene Viernes and Selmy Domingo were unafraid. They were just these young guys willing to, you know, challenge the status quo and fight for fairness. And they died young, but their family and friends continued that fight. And they've been working to hold powerful interests accountable, whether it's a foreign dictator or the U.S. government. They're just willing to follow this fight wherever it takes them.
Thanks, Ashley.
You're welcome.
Ashley Gross is a reporter at KNKX. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is Truth to Power. Seattle likes to think of itself as a progressive place, but it has a complicated history to reckon with. One chapter of that story is set in North Seattle at a roadside restaurant owned by a guy named Maxon Lester Graham. It was called the Coon Chicken Inn, and its whole brand was based on a racist stereotype of African Americans. But back in the 1930s, very few Seattleites took much issue with the restaurant. Catherine Roth wrote about the Coon Chicken Inn for a civil rights history project, and she filled this in.
It was sort of just a very basic building, but the entrance is what was remarkable. It was this giant head that you would walk through the mouth to get into this restaurant, and it was of a caricature of an African-American male known as the Coon, wearing a porter's hat, really enlarged lips, smiling and winking. The character of the coon, or the caricature of the coon, dates back to the 19th century minstrel shows with this character named Zip Coon, who became really popular in northern cities, especially in the post-Civil War years where white northerners were really kind of scared and uncomfortable with the, you know, liberation of black people and the migration of black people to northern cities, and used minstrelsy and used all of these racist imagery as ways to reinforce white supremacy, sort of provide some comfort of superiority for working class whites, especially.
And for patrons, once they walk through the head, like what would they have seen and so on after that?
Right. Yeah. So the menu was also this giant logo. So the image was everywhere. It was prevalent throughout the restaurant. And I think the original advertisement when they opened in the Seattle Times was how it was served from a mammy. So this is another example of just like reinforcing this black stereotype of like black people know how to serve chicken. And here we have this authentic fried chicken for you from the South, even though the owners were from Salt Lake City. For black Seattleites, this was extremely problematic.
And what was the kind of racial backdrop of the Seattle area at this time? We're talking about the late 20s. How integrated or segregated was this part of town? And where were we in the kind of arc of racial segregation here at that time?
Seattle is extremely segregated. So there were these lines in property deeds called racially restrictive covenants that kind of stipulated who could and could not live in certain neighborhoods and in certain places. So this is something that you would find in pretty much every North Seattle neighborhood, and people of color in the Seattle area were really restricted in what neighborhoods they could live in. So you see the rise of what became the Central District or the or Chinatown or parts of South Seattle that were places that people of color were permitted to live based on property deeds.
So there was this kind of beacon of racism just north of town, pretty far away from the areas where African Americans were permitted to buy and rent homes. How did the imagery and the presence of this place infiltrate the rest of the region?
So Lester Graham offered a delivery service, and he had a few delivery cars that really boldly displayed the logo on the sides of the car. If you look at the advertisements, they say they'll deliver to any part of the city and like all day until 2 a.m. So this was an opportunity for this image to travel throughout Seattle.
Wow. And then it wasn't just the delivery cars too, right? He had these like these tire covers.
This is another big gimmick he used to advertise. So Lester Graham ordered thousands of these spare tire covers to be put on people's spare tires on the back of their cars. And I think he gave them away as sort of a gimmicky advertising stunt. So people would actually, I think of like the Jack in the Box jack that you used to put on top of an antenna like back in the 90s or something like that. That I think that's sort of the idea, that this was a way to just get the logo out there and get free
the
advertising.
Burger King crown.
Yes, exactly. So people use this, and people would put these on the back of their cars and drive around with this image.
Wow. What are some of the ways that African Americans and anti-racist groups at the time registered their displeasure?
So one story of resistance to this image was this guy, Joseph Staton, who talked in this oral history interview back in the 1970s about how him and a couple of his friends decided to have this contest to sort of protest the spare tire cover logo. And they put 50 cents into a pot and decided that at the end of 30 days, whoever could cut out the most tire covers or the logo of the tire cover would win the pot.
And what do you mean cut out?
Like physically with a knife, like go and cut out this coon head logo.
So they would see a car with the cover on it. They would take a knife, cut it out, and
they would, yeah, get out of their car, go take this knife, cut it out, and then, yeah, go away with it. So sort of this vandalism to protest. And he was actually arrested and booked for this vandalism. And the story goes that he, when he was in front of the judge asked to see whatever he cut out, and he showed them the tire cover, and the judge supposedly laughed and fined him $3.
Implying that the judge was at least somewhat sympathetic.
At least aware that this this was sort of an understandable act of resistance, of vandalism.
Yeah. So besides these individual acts of protest, were there anything more organized?
Yes, definitely. There was a really focused and organized civil rights movement in the 30s. And in 1930, basically as soon as the Coon Chicken Inn opened, they filed a complaint against the restaurant for defamation of race and were trying to get the Coon Chicken Inn to change their logo and their form of advertising.
Yeah. Well, how effective were the protests against Coon Chicken Inn?
So initially, they had a slight victory in that Lester Graham agreed to cut out the spare tire covers to stop producing them and to change the color of the logo.
What did it look like after they made those changes?
Right. So by 1931, the Northwest Enterprise published that they were again pursuing the Coon Chicken Inn because they were still producing these tire covers and they had changed the color of the logo to red, but that this was still a really prevalent image and that this was problematic. By 1930,
it still looked very much like the Coon head, right?
I mean, it was still like, so by 1932, the logo was turned blue. So if you look at like later productions of this logo, it's still obviously blackface and still obviously this caricature, but it just happens to be this shade of blue and it doesn't say the word Coon on it. So that was their way to avoid a lawsuit, but it was still very clear what the message was.
And you write about this overall kind of white indifference to the really offensive dimension of this restaurant. What can you tell us about that? And what does it say about the particular characteristics of racism and racial prejudice in the Northwest?
Yeah, white Seattleites were very indifferent to this image, and I think were much more concerned with class issues at the time than they were with race issues. I think it just shows that there were a lot of racial tensions in the Northwest, and the Northwest was this deeply prejudiced place. And Seattle, we like to think of ourselves as this like very liberal city with this liberal history, and a lot of people don't really understand just how deeply rooted racism is in this region.
Well, what role did those protests play in the eventual demise of this restaurant?
I mean, this is the tragedy of the push for civil rights in the 1930s and 1940s, is that this was sort of like unsuccessful resistance. I mean, it was successful and they removed some of these tire cover logos, or they got the color of the logo changed to blue from black and the word Coon erased from the teeth. But really, like, the image remained and it remained a very popular restaurant. And it never closed because of the protests. Nothing really changed because of the protests. So the restaurant ended up closing in the late 1940s because of a decision by Lester Graham to turn it into an army surplus store instead.
And that is sort of somehow deeply unsatisfying.
Absolutely.
Was there ever any kind of vindication then for the protesters?
I mean, maybe the personal satisfaction of knowing that you like removed this logo from someone's car, but you know, not really. It was sort of this, I think the Northwest Enterprise, the black newspaper, after the lawsuit in 1932, their articles like Coon Chicken and Dodge's lawsuit. So basically, no, there was no satisfactory ending for resisting this logo. It remained.
Yeah. So looking back on it, I mean, what do you think that we have to learn from this episode of Seattle's history?
I mean, I think that the Coon Chicken Inn really was this beacon of bigotry that existed in North Seattle during the 30s and 40s, and really provides a interesting window to look into the racial dynamics of the city at the time. And just to be reminded that the city was a deeply segregated and deeply racist place during the 20th century, first half of the 20th century. And the legacy of these racially restrictive covenants, the legacy of this sort of cultural racism of this Coon Chicken Inn logo still remain. And it's something that we actively need to be working on as a city.
Catherine Roth wrote about the Coon Chicken Inn for the University of Washington Seattle Civil Rights and Labor History Project, as well as blackpast.org and HistoryLink. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today the show is all about truth to power. Every day, we interact with giant, faceless corporations that do things we may or may not agree with. And it's easy to feel powerless. Like, how do you go about confronting an Amazon or a Starbucks? Well, it turns out you can have a say for a very particular price, $2,000. Specifically, $2,000 worth of stock. That's what it takes to put forward shareholder resolutions and generally force a company to at least listen to you. Sister Judy Byron, a nun of the Adrian Dominican Order, knows this really well.
The shareholders own the companies. It doesn't always seem like that, but they do. And so that puts a great responsibility on us for what the companies are doing.
Sister Judy grew up as the oldest of seven in a Catholic family in Hoquiam. She's been wielding her power as a shareholder for the last two decades. Among the companies that she's been able to steer in a more ethical direction are Hershey's, Hyatt Hotels, and Walmart. Holding the corporate world accountable is not what Sister Judy had in mind when she was 18 years old and entered the convent.
When I entered in 1960, we wore the long habits and veils, etc. And I thought probably for the rest of my life I'd wear the habit. I'd get up every morning, I'd walk across the parking lot and teach school, and that would be my life.
And it was, for a while. Sister Judy was a teacher and a school principal for many years.
And in those years, I mean, we taught the math, we taught science, reading, etc., but we also looked at the news of the day and what was happening, and I was very concerned about justice issues. Like when I was teaching, you know, the kids, we'd look at the issue of homelessness and why people were homeless, and, you know, then also what we could do about that.
Then an opportunity came up that offered Sister Judy a different way to have an impact. She took a job as director of the Northwest Coalition for Responsible Investment. See, nuns do have a little bit of money, and like all of us, they have to manage it.
The religious communities have some investments, really meager investments compared to what many people have, but we have investments that we use for our retirement.
The Northwest Coalition for Responsible Investment uses this money as leverage, as a way to get the attention of corporate board members and CEOs. Sister Judy, along with a small army of other sisters, plus a few men, use their leverage to force companies to confront issues like pollution, child labor, job safety, and sex trafficking. And now these corporate watchdogs have waded into one of our more polarizing issues by investing in companies that manufacture guns. They're not looking to get rid of guns, but they are directly asking the companies how they plan to help reduce the numbers of lives lost to guns in the United States. Sister Judy sat down with me to explain how it's playing out.
We were realizing that whenever something happens, you hear from, there's a statement from everyone, from the president, even the NRA will make a statement. But we never were hearing from the gun manufacturers or the retailers. So we decided that we would begin to engage them. So we bought shares in Sturmberger and American Outdoor Brands, which are the two main publicly held manufacturers, and Dick's Sporting Goods. So we decided we would file shareholder resolutions, which we did with Dick's in December of 2018, and then Sturmberger and American Outdoor Brands in early January 2018. The resolutions asked them for a report on what they were doing to monitor violent incidents where their products were involved, what they were doing to develop safer guns. You know, there's a lot of new technology out that's in your cell phone, that's in your car lock, you're everywhere. And what were they doing to use some of that technology to make guns safer so that, only the owner of the gun can use it. And then the other was what the reputational and financial risks to were to their company because of gun violence if they didn't do something about this. We had the Sturmruger annual meeting in May, and 69% of the shareholders supported it.
So it passed. Wow.
A majority vote. You don't often get majority votes.
Well, what's it like for you personally to get those types of victories?
Well, the important thing for me is the people that the issue impacts. You know, like when I think of gun violence, you know, when I was teaching, I mean, we would have earthquake drills because I was around here. We'd have fire drills, but we never had lockdowns. And I know I have a grandnephew, and he's in first grade, and his teacher told his mother that when they have those lockdowns, he's just shaking. He's so afraid that somebody's in their school with a gun. And so to me, you know, that's why I'm doing this. Or the young people at Parkland, I mean, I could not, you know, their courage and how articulate they were just right after that, and what they've done now on this issue, you know, spent their summer registering 50,000 new voters, got more young people to vote in this election. You know, we can't let the kids do the heavy lifting on this issue. We as adults and legislators, et cetera, really need to step up.
So when you are able to at least make a connection with the decision makers, a CEO or a high up executive, do they typically have to be dragged kicking and screaming to your point of view, or do you make believers out of them sometimes?
You know, a company that we've worked with since the 90s is Walmart. And, you know, Walmart has made great progress over the years. And now there's a group of us, about 12 of us, that meets every year with Walmart to discuss social and environmental issues. And the CEO always spends about an hour with us looking at kind of emerging issues, like everyone is looking now at the future of work. You know, they want to be a good company. They want to be the company that people want to work for, and they want to be the company that people want to buy from. And they realize that they have to be a good citizen, you know, as an employer, et cetera, for people to want to do that. So, you know, now we're starting to work with Amazon, the shareholders are. And, you know, they're kind of where Walmart was back in the 90s, where, you know, there are all these issues and they're developing so fast that they're not used to interacting with their shareholders. They pretty much think they know what to do and do it. So it'll be interesting to see where we are in 10 years with Amazon, you know, on all the issues, because, you know, obviously they're a big player. It's good work. I mean, I really, I look forward when I get up in the morning to what I'm going to do. And wish I could do it all, but realize, you know, you can't.
Sister Judy Byron is a sister of the Adrian Dominican Order and director of the Northwest Coalition for Responsible Investment. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner, with help this week from Ashley Gross. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. Our show is also a podcast. You can hear just about all of our episodes, plus bonus peeks behind the curtain when you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or wherever you listen. We're back next week when the theme is Watch Your Language. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.